You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's new poet laureate was recently announced. We'll hear how she hopes to reach the state's elderly and memory-impaired population through poetry.
First, almost 70 years ago, George Orwell published one of his signature works of fiction, the novel 1984. The story looked at a society where facts were distorted and ideas were suppressed.
Now, in 2017, the book seems to be making a comeback, and it might be in part because of this remark from top Donald Trump aide Kellyanne Conway. She was on Meet the Press with Chuck Todd talking about disproved claims by White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. Here's a listen.
Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered.
Hey, Chuck,
was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
The book 1984 made its way to the top of the Amazon bestseller list not long after Conway's comments about alternative facts over a week ago. The company that publishes the book also said sales have risen about 10,000% since the inauguration.
Jerry Canavan joins us now. He's an assistant professor of English focusing on science fiction and fantasy fiction at Marquette University. Jerry, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Jerry, why do you think that the novel 1984 has become so popular?
Well, the sorts of issues you're talking about with regard to alternate facts and some of the spin doctoring that's been happening in politics certainly seems to be a huge part of it, as well as a general kind of bipartisan distrust of the government, depending on who's in power, right? Going back at least as far as the Bush years, every 8 years or so, we switch parties and we decide that the government has been taken over by monsters, and we just kind of go back and forth. So now Democrats have found themselves out of power and are petrified of the government's powers.
So you're saying this is a bipartisan thing, and every 4 to 8 years, 1984 gets a little boost?
Well, I think you've seen the same kinds of problems when Obama took office, right, where Obama was being compared to Nazis and other sorts of things. I don't think you saw the same kind of increase in 1984 sales 8 years ago. That seems to be very particular about this moment and particular to the way Trump and his people kind of present themselves rhetorically.
Now, for those of us who haven't read the book, can you give us a Cliff Notes version? What happens in it?
Oh, I'll do my best. So it takes place a little bit in the future from the moment it was written, in a post-atomic war landscape where the world has been taken over essentially by three supernations. And it focuses on a man named Winston Smith who works for the Ministry of Truth, whose job it is to redact historical records to fit with whatever the regime is now saying is true. And so his job essentially is to rewrite history to fit whatever the government, which is led by a figure named Big Brother, who may not actually exist, says at the time.
And Big Brother, that's one of the terms mm-hmm. that has gone on to have a life of its own after the book. There are other terms, it sounds like, mm-hmm. that come from this book that seem to have cultural relevance from time mm-hmm. to time over the years. What are some of those?
Well, one of the major things that happens in the book is that the government develops this new language, which it calls newspeak, in order to basically prevent people from having the capacity to imagine freedom or democracy. And so it tries to narrow down what it's capable to think and say. And so sometimes you see people mocking authoritarian governments or government press releases with stuff like double plus ungood, which is a newspeak phrase. Double think, right? The idea of holding two contradictory ideas in your mind at once when the regime requires you to, things like this. So newspeak is a major part of what makes 1984 such a compelling book.
Can you give us a little background on where George Orwell got his inspiration for this book, what mm-hmm. he was thinking about at the time?
Well, I mean, he was thinking a little bit about what he thought the future of the world might look like, right? So 1984 is 1948 reversed, right? The year he was writing the book, and he's thinking a lot about what might happen. So he's thinking about the USSR, but he's also thinking about trends he sees in the Western democracies as well. And of course, he's very influenced by the rise of fascism in Germany. So he's kind of imagining, well, what could happen if these trends continue? And in part, he's thinking a lot about mass media, right? So one of the major innovations in the book is the telescreen, which is a television, but it also has a camera that can kind of look out at you. And so imagining that kind of total surveillance society that suddenly seems possible in the 20th century.
We're talking right now with Jerry Canavan, assistant professor of English, focusing on science fiction and fantasy at Marquette University. And he's with us right now to talk about the sudden interest in George Orwell's book, 1984. And how do you think, Jerry, people might see this book when one of the top news stories in the past several months has been the proliferation of fake news, and everyone seems to have their own definition of exactly what fake news is?
1984 is this powerful statement about the importance of truth and memory, and what happens when you kind of lose a sense of that kind of shared consensus reality, right, which is what's happened to America to a large extent over the last 15, 16 years or so. We've really split into at least two nations, everybody getting their own facts. And in the last campaign, of course, we saw this proliferation of stories that you never know if anything's true when you read it on the internet. And so that kind of feeling of loss and disorientation, I think, has drawn people back to that book. What happens to a country that can't know what's true anymore?
Really struck by your phrase, shared consensus reality. Do you really think that we ever had that? I mean, I know the internet gives everyone their own little niche to hide out in and get information, but did we ever really have shared consensus reality?
I mean, to an extent, I think one of the things you've seen over the 20th century, right, is the expansion of participation in government to a much wider section of people, right? So when pretty much white men were running everything, they had a consensus reality that just left out everybody else, right? So that wasn't so great either, for sure. But our institutions haven't really caught up to a world where people fundamentally disagree on basic facts, right? So even now, questions about global warming, right, whether or not it's true or it's a hoax, questions about the reality of polling, whether polling is accurate, right? All of these stories have transformed themselves into the point where it's hard sometimes to talk to somebody who watches the other news channel or reads the other websites. You get a totally different sense of what's happening in the world.
Do you think that the people who are reading 1984 right now, are they looking at it as a manual for how to turn things around? Or is this just sort of bleak reading and they're going to read in it maybe what they want to read?
It's a terrible manual for how to turn things around. One of the nightmarish things about 1984 is that the opposition movement is also part of the government. It's just a different agency within the government. And so as Winston Smith kind of gets drawn into the resistance, he's basically being made a fool because the government is also running that. And so the end of the book doesn't offer you any kind of hope about overthrowing the regime really much at all. So as a kind of strategy for resistance, it's actually kind of heartbreaking and terrible. So I think it's more about kind of inhabiting your unhappiness about the Trump election and kind of wallowing a little bit in that feeling of helplessness now that everything went a different way than a lot of people were expecting in November.
Do you think it's been read different ways over the years, sort of a cipher for whatever times that we're in?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's because it's so pliable and because there's such a disconnect between the moment of it's being written and the moment in which the events take place, it can kind of constantly come back. And so there are elements of it that now seem to really speak to like the Twitter age, right? This kind of sense of constant surveillance, of constantly having to perform the proper emotions for everybody at all times, having no privacy, having nowhere you can go where you're not reachable by your employer or by the police or by somebody else, right? A world that's really kind of constrained. And I think we feel that way a lot now with cell phones and Twitter and social media. We kind of have this sense of the world watching us at all times. I think that slogan, Big Brother is watching you, feels truer now than maybe it did when I was younger.
Do you think there's still new things to find in it as people read it now, a different point in history? It's not 1948, it's 2017. Is there still something new there?
I mean, to an extent, it is a kind of timeless story about the worst thing that can happen to a government. To another extent, it does feel, I think, a little bit stale, as sometimes dystopias do. It feels like a picture of what you can avoid. And if you're not doing that, then everything's fine. And so sometimes it seems to me that the best dystopias are the ones that are a little more cartoonish, like Terry Gilliam's Brazil or something like that, right? That feels more harrowing to me personally than 1984 does, because what we're facing is not exactly the nightmarish villainy of 1984. It's this other kind of very strange thing that seems to be happening in the government right now.
Leave it there. Jerry, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jerry Canavan. He's an assistant professor of English focusing on science fiction and fantasy fiction at Marquette University. And he was with us to talk about the new interest in George Orwell's book, 1984. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, the Boy Scouts of America will allow transgender boys to join, according to an announcement last night. We'll find out what was behind that shift in policy.
First, Wisconsin has a new incoming poet laureate, Carla Houston. She's the author of 8 chapbooks of poems and a poetry collection called A Theory of Lipstick. For that collection, Houston received an Outstanding Achievement Award from the Wisconsin Library Association.
During her term as poet laureate, Houston plans to share her love of poetry with all Wisconsin residents, and she's particularly interested in working with the elderly and memory impaired.
Carla Houston, Wisconsin's new poet laureate, joins us now. Carla, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here. I love your program, so thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you for the kind words. Well, you have an exciting new role ahead of you. What was your reaction to being named Wisconsin's poet laureate?
I was pretty surprised. There are a lot of really fine poets in the state of Wisconsin, so I was pleased and flattered and surprised and very, very happy.
And how do you see your role as poet laureate for the state?
I really love poetry, so I feel my role primarily is to represent the other really fine poets in the state of Wisconsin, those people who love poetry and those people who aren't too sure about it.
I wonder if you could read us one of your poems now. You shared one possible poem, My Father's Horns. Can you tell us about that one and maybe give us a read?
Yes. My father played tuba in a polka band for more than 30 years in the La Crosse area. And so this poem is for him and his many bass horns that he had. My Father's Horns. Saturday nights he jammed the van, the upright silver bass, or the curvy sousaphone. Back then, the gang played standards, some oompa-pas and little waltzes, and packed the dance floor with suits and full circle skirts. Sometimes a pretty woman sang. My father drove home after, half asleep, a little jazzed, his throat choked with smoke. The horns, their big bells silent, settled once more in the back. Those Saturday night beauties, the ones he held tight, the ones he crooned to, my mother keeping time at home.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you for reading that. And this is so Wisconsin, and you said it was a polka band that he was in.
Yes.
And so now you're pulled. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say he played for many years with the Jerry Gilbertson Orchestra in the La Crosse area.
Hmm. I know this is a very Wisconsin poem, and you're our state poet laureate. You grew up in Wisconsin, a La Crosse area, and I think you're in the Fox Cities now. Is there something special about writing poetry in Wisconsin and the connection to the state?
Well, you know, Wisconsin has, a lot of unique things about it, from our beer to our Packers to our weather to our ability to survive all of those things. I think also place is very important in my poetry. When we're located in an area, we find our roots and are able to, you know, become successful and see ourselves as where we've landed.
How did you become a poet? How do you know that this is something that you want to be when you grow up?
Oh, I didn't know that. I was actually started quite late. I didn't write poetry in the closet as a child. I went back to school late in life and got a degree in English and was hired to teach high school English and including creative writing at Nina High School, where I worked for 15 years. And I was interested and really liked the wordplay and compression of writing poetry, so I started doing my students' assignments. Then I started taking classes, and it just, you know, exploded from there.
Yeah, given that you've taught poetry writing, what would be your advice to someone thinking, oh, maybe I should try my hand at poetry, but they don't know where to start?
Oh, I would encourage them to become voracious readers of poetry. I don't think that you can really understand the conversation that's going on in the poetry world without being a reader of that. And then, of course, I think that the next step, and maybe two steps taken, coinciding, would be to write. Just do it. Just get out your pen and your paper and start putting words on paper and start playing with them and enjoying the process, listening to the sounds of the words, trying to make meaning of all of the things you put down on your piece of paper.
You mentioned you read a lot, other poets. Who were some of your influences along the way?
Well, I particularly liked women poets, and particularly contemporary women poets. There are a lot of really fine contemporary women poets out there. Probably my favorite poet is Darian Lux, and I've been following her poetry for 20 years. But there are too many to name, and if I leave somebody out, I don't want anyone to feel they've been neglected. But I read a lot. And I also write poetry reviews, so that allows me to be able to read poets whose books I might not normally pick up.
We're talking to Carla Houston. She is Wisconsin's new poet laureate. And Carla, I understand you've said that you want to bring poetry to people who suffer from memory loss, maybe people dealing with dementia. How can poetry be helpful to them?
Well, I think that poetry has the same ability as music to tap into memory, to bring back things that a person might have forgotten. Poetry has a musical quality to it. Often you don't even notice it because contemporary poetry doesn't rhyme. But there's an echoing of words and sounds in contemporary poems. A lot of contemporary poetry deals with memory and place. And so there's a resonance in experience. I may not, for example, have had an experience like you did with your father playing, tuba in a polka band, but I have an experience similar to that. And or I may remember a band, or I remember a dance that I attended when I was young. And so I think poetry has that ability to draw and touch people perhaps in places that they've forgotten.
You participate in memory cafes as well. Can you tell us what that experience is like?
Well, I've only done one memory cafe so far, but I have another one scheduled next month, and I'm very much looking forward to working with the folks at the Appleton Public Library. I wasn't quite sure what to expect with the first memory cafe that I attended. I had a plan in mind. And I think I read my poem, My Father's Horns, and the whole group erupted with stories of first dates and dance halls in Outagamie County that they remembered. And it was wonderful. Everyone started talking and chattering. And I was quite surprised because I was expecting to follow this little plan I had down on my piece of paper, and it didn't work out that way. But I think it worked out really well.
And that's inspired you to join in more of those memory cafes?
Yes, I think that the people particularly who are suffering from mild forms of dementia and memory loss and their caregivers are looking for ways that they can reconnect and connect within the community. Aging, especially when you're losing your memory, is very isolating. So the memory cafes throughout the state, and I was looking at the memory cafe directory online this afternoon, and it lists 65 cities, not including Milwaukee, with memory cafes, and some cities with multiple locations. For example, the Fox Valley Memory Project, I believe there are 7 memory cafes in the Fox Valley associated with that. So there's lots of opportunities to get out and talk to people and work with people, work with recitations with people, maybe creating group poems together, some way to be able to join in this community. I'm really looking forward to the experience.
Do you think that part of what's powerful about this kind of work using poetry and memory loss is that it's creating art. It's doing something creative, even when you might not have what you need to tell a novel from front to end. But you can tell a poem, and you can still create.
I agree. And so many of the elderly were required when they were in school to memorize poems. And surprisingly, they remember some of the lines, if not the entire poem. But they remember some of the lines because they've, you know, internalized them. When you memorize something, you internalize it. And so it's always there somewhere inside of you.
More broadly, getting back to poetry in general, I think of reading poetry, of course, but it seems like there's been a boom in poetry slams, various kinds of spoken word, live poetry performance. So what do we get out of going and seeing people read their poetry out loud as opposed to just reading it in a book?
Well, it becomes a performance. It's the difference between reading a play and in a book and going to see the performance of that play. You get to see the nuances of the reader or the performer, how he or she handles the work, how he or she presents the work. Interestingly, often poetry slams, the presenters have memorized the poems, and so they are not only reciting them, but they're acting the parts in the poems. So they're quite extraordinary.
Carla, we're living in a time right now when it seems like there's this incredible focus on politics. There's a transition from one White House administration to the other. I know that Rob and I get a lot of our ideas for things on Twitter, and now it's become almost exclusively about politics. Against this kind of backdrop, why does poetry matter?
You know, there's a quote, and I'm going to do it badly, I'm sure, but it's from a poem by Carlos Williams called Asphodel, that greeny flower, where he says, and this is a paraphrase, that it's difficult to get the news from poems, but men, and I'm going to insert women, die every day for lack of what is found there. I think poetry has the ability, particularly in times of political strife, personal strife, to do something for us that no other kind of writing can. We turn to poetry when we've lost someone dear to us. We use poems at weddings and other celebrations. And of course, poetry brings us, I think, back to the heart of the matter.
Carla, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here today. Thank you.
That was Carla Houston, Wisconsin's new poet laureate.
Coming up, the Boy Scouts of America will allow transgender boys to join the organization. It's a big shift. We'll talk to a guest who says it's a good move. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's live coverage of President Trump's announcement of his new Supreme Court Justice nominee. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, a major change of policy. The Boy Scouts of America has announced that it will allow transgender boys to enroll in scouting programs all across the United States. Here's Chief Scout Executive Michael Serbaugh, who announced the change in a video statement yesterday.
After weeks of significant conversations at all levels of our organization, we realized that referring to birth certificates as the reference point is no longer sufficient.
The policy change comes about after a transgender boy in New Jersey was barred from the organization about a month after joining, a story that made national headlines. The Boy Scouts have been criticized in the past as being reluctant to embrace social change, but in recent years the group has moved away from bans on gay scouts and gay adult leaders in the organization, all moves that our next guest says were steps in the right direction.
Justin Wilson is with us now to talk more about this shift in policy. He's the executive director of the group Scouts for Equality. He's also an Eagle Scout and has spent over 15 years as a registered member of the Boy Scouts of America and has held numerous positions within the organization. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, but is a former resident of Madison, Wisconsin. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
So first off, Justin, what was your reaction when this news broke yesterday?
Well, I was surprised it happened as quick as it did, but instantly I just felt a lot of excitement and I was very elated to hear it. I was also instantly proud of the Boy Scouts for taking this step more or less on their own, really showing that they are now ready and willing to keep up with our society as it changes.
It seemed to come as a surprise to some people. Why do you think they made this decision at this particular point in time?
Well, I think that as they were thinking over this one young boy who had been removed from the program, I can only think that they thought of the human impact of how it was not fair for that young boy. And I think they also wanted to avoid any prolonged public battles on this topic. They fought the inclusion of gay, bisexual, and lesbian members for over 30 years. And so I just don't think they wanted to get back into that situation again.
And as we were talking about earlier, this change may have been brought about in part, at least, due to a case out of New Jersey. Can you tell us about that story in more detail?
Yeah, so Joe Maldonado, an 8-year-old transgender boy, had asked his mom if he could join Cub Scouts. She cautiously allowed him to join, and about a month afterwards, a parent in the unit complained, and he was told by the Boy Scouts that he could not be in Cub Scouts any longer. So he was very brave, and him and his mom decided to speak out about this. So they spoke out, their story was heard, and we saw a lot of public support quickly come to Joe and supporting him in his efforts to rejoin scouting.
It's a time when across the country, different states are still working out how they're going to approach transgender rights, what sorts of policies they want to make. And so the Boy Scouts here are maybe taking a stance that might not be completely in step with what some states themselves decide. How do you think that part of it will end up playing out?
Yeah, so the Boy Scouts as a national organization needs a comprehensive national policy. And what they've done now is actually pretty much in line with the federal guidance we've gotten so far for schools in relation to transgender children. And so I think they're actually all pretty closely aligned with where the federal government is at this point.
So does that mean that the Boy Scouts themselves are also coming from a position of agreement within the scouting community, the families who are part of the Scouts organization?
You know, it's difficult to say what level of agreement there would be if we were to put this out to the public scouting community. I suspect many people support it. I suspect many people might have questions or not support it. But what we're hoping is that the Boy Scouts will be able to, over time, produce resources which can help educate people on this topic so that they're less afraid of it.
And what sort of reaction have you heard so far?
From the folks that we work with, just overwhelmingly positive, a lot of surprise that the Boy Scouts did this proactively, and a lot of people who are just grateful that that their child, if they're transgender, no longer has to be afraid of being in Boy Scouts and being open and honest about themselves.
We're talking right now with Justin Wilson from the group Scouts for Equality about the Boy Scouts' decision to allow transgender boys to join their ranks. And Justin, the Boy Scouts, they've been criticized in the past as a group that has been painted sometimes as reluctant to change. Do you think that with this announcement that that is changing and they're moving in a different direction?
Absolutely. It doesn't change who they are fundamentally as an organization, because as an organization, fundamentally, they're just a great organization that provides tremendous value to millions of kids throughout the country. And so what I think we're seeing is that as the times are changing, they are now finally getting in step with that, and they've got leadership at the top of the organization that's willing to make the tough decisions sometimes to stay in step with society rather than to lag behind it.
Right, and given that, I mean, do you think that this decision has been made from the inside, or do you think that the Scouts could be, in part at least, responding to social pressure or political pressure?
Undoubtedly, the media response to Joe being kicked out certainly triggered some discussions within the Boy Scouts, but compared to the work that we did for the inclusion of lesbian, gay, and bisexual scouts and leaders, we really did very little, almost nothing here to push the Boy Scouts. And so I think that this is a great example of the Boy Scouts looking inside internally and just simply making the right choice.
Justin Wilson is with us right now from the group Scouts for Equality, and we're talking about the Boy Scouts' recent decision to allow transgender boys to join the Scouts.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of this change to allow transgender boys in the Boy Scouts? Is it important for scouting to be more inclusive, or is this just caving into political pressure? If you have scouting in your background, let us know what you think. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now with Justin Wilson, executive director of the group Scouts for Equality. We're talking about the Boy Scouts' decision to allow transgender boys to join the organization, and you can join in at 800-642-1234.
And we want to hear from you. What do you make of this policy change? If you were a scout or work with the Scouts organization, what do you think of it? And do you think it is important for scouting to be more inclusive? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Justin, what do you think happens if individual troops of Boy Scouts or units disagree with a decision like this? Do they have any recourse?
You know, that's a good question. The policy change appears to be national in scope and final, so I don't think there's going to be any further changes to it. However, there's still some answers that are a little bit unclear in terms of how this will be implemented in local units. And what I suspect we're going to see is the Boy Scouts working with families on an individual basis to make sure that their child ends up in a scout troop that not only allows them to be there, but actually truly accepts them and uplifts them for who they are. So that's what I hope we'll see from the Boy Scouts.
We're going to take our first caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jesse on the line in Sturgeon Bay. Jesse, hi.
Hi, how's it going, guys? Love the show.
Good. What did you want to share?
I actually became an Eagle Scout back in 2006, and I find the inclusiveness that we're beginning to see now to be very, well, forward-moving for them, especially after what happened with all the humdrum over the anti-gay and everything that they had started back in 2011, 2012, or whatever. I'm just really glad that we're moving forward as an organization and becoming more inclusive of other people's.
And Jesse, are you surprised by this move at all?
No. Personally, I think that eventually we should all be moving forward, and I'm really glad that they are. I guess I would be a little surprised that it's happening now with everything that's going on politically and all the other things, but when we look at it, we have a very divisive country over things like this, but we are moving more and more retroactively towards goals of inclusiveness among other people.
Jesse, thanks a lot for the comments and the kind words about the show. And Justin, Jesse saying this is a good direction for the Scouts, and he thinks it's forward-looking of them.
And I'm glad to hear that. You know, some people say that when the Boy Scouts made their policy changes related to gay adult leaders, that they were forced into it, that the Boy Scouts wouldn't make changes like that on their own. And I think yesterday's decision shows that they are willing to make these decisions on their own, and they can make good decisions to become more inclusive. So we're very proud of them.
Jesse, thanks a lot. And we move next to Robert joining us in Milwaukee. Robert, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good,
I just
thanks.
Wanted to say that I was a Cub Scout, and it was, you know, it was lots of fun. It was cool. And I guess I just, in thinking about this now and thinking about the whole issue, and I just, you know, I'm kind of wondering why in this day and age it has to be a boys-only group at all. Why is it called Boy Scouts? Why can't it just be called, you know, Scouts?
Interesting, Robert. Thanks for that question. Justin, what do you say to that?
No, I think that's a great observation. And personally, I would love it if we allowed troops the option to include whatever genders they want. Right now, we're focusing on the big accomplishment that Joe's made today by allowing transgender boys, and we're going to make sure that goes smoothly. Once that's in place, we'll continue to monitor the Boy Scouts and see if there's any other ways that we can continue to encourage them to become even more diverse and inclusive.
Robert, thanks a lot for the question. And Justin, other than the genders and the cookies, I mean, are the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts demonstrably different in culture and the kinds of things that they do with kids?
Well, I don't know a lot about the Girl Scout program in terms of what they do on a daily basis with the kids, but I can tell you organizationally and structurally, they are very different organizations, a lot more than we have time to go into today. But suffice to say, they're very different organizations, and I understand that they operate differently.
Robert, thanks again. And we'll go next to Jerry from Waukesha. Jerry calling us at 800-642-1234. And Jerry, what do you think?
Well, I'm a little bothered, to say the least. Like I explained earlier, my son's been a scout since he was a Cub Scout. He's almost an Eagle Scout. He's been in the organization about 10 years. And Scouts, Boy Scouts of America, is one of the last fabrics of America and Americana that hasn't been desecrated by political correctness. So my concern is, so that the individual that the changes were made for is going to sign up as the gender that he associates with. Is that he or she?
Well, it would be Justin, you were answering.
Yeah,
I'll let you go ahead.
Yep, that'd be he. Yep, he.
Yeah, so if he is of the alternate sex, he then will be using the women's restroom and bunking with the female scout leaders as opposed to the general population. Is that correct?
The Boy Scouts have not released any details around lodging arrangements in relation to this policy, but I would expect that this transgender boy would share the same facilities as the other boys.
And Justin, what about what Jerry said about the organization he thought was being desecrated by political correctness? It hadn't been until this point. What do you think about, is it being overly politically correct?
Well, first of all, I thank him and commend him for sharing a view that is in opposition to what I'm sharing, for having the courage to do that. And I don't see this as an issue of political correctness. I see this as an issue of trying to not do any harm to this little boy who wants to be in scouting, and to try to expand the scouting program to allow as many families as possible to participate.
Thanks for that call, Jerry. Appreciate that. And we're going to go next to David in the Wisconsin Dells. Hi, David.
Hi. I was an Eagle Boy Scout. It's been a while. I'm in my 60s now, but I'm totally opposed to this. I think a child, and they are children at 11 years old when you go into Boy Scouts, shouldn't be determining their sexual orientation. I think they should live within the skin that they were born with, and they should be pointed maybe towards a minister or a counselor, and not encouraged to be living a life that they weren't born to live. And like I said, I'm totally opposed to it.
David, thanks for the comments. And Justin, what do you say to David?
Yeah, so this is something that's new for some people, and I would encourage people like David to try to find families with transgender individuals in them that they can speak to and learn more about this. This is not a fleeting thing in this child's life. When a child identifies as transgender, it's something that is consistent, persistent, and insistent are some of the words we use to describe how they describe themselves. And I defer to the psychologists and the psychiatrists on this, who support the idea that children should be allowed to self-identify with their gender identity at a young age.
And Justin, does this decision pertain only to Boy Scouts? Sounds like that's 11 years up and older. Or is it also for the younger kids, the Eagle Scouts?
Yeah, so this is for Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, which are the two boys-only programs. And there's also a co-ed program called Venturing. And they had already said that transgender youth were welcome in Venturing because of the nature of that program already including boys and girls.
And Justin, there are challenges for organizations like the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts as they go into the future and they face competition from things like technology. Just briefly, do you see a strong future ahead for the Boy Scouts?
Absolutely. There's a lot of competing interests right now, but the values and the lessons in scouting are timeless. I'm involved as a troop leader now, and every month we have scouts who bring friends with who are excited to go out and learn these outdoorsman skills. So I think scouting's here to stay.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Justin Wilson, the executive director of Scouts for Equality, and he joined us to talk about the Boy Scouts of America's decision to allow transgender boys to join the organization.
Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark still gets the occasional mention as a possible Trump administration appointee, but a citizen's complaint against Clark and lawsuits over deaths at the Milwaukee County Jail may have stalled the sheriff's chances for a high-ranking federal job. The controversies have also given hope to those who would like to see Clark leave office, but he remains popular with some voters. Chuck Kornbach reports.
Sheriff Clark doesn't give many local interviews these days and declined a request from WPR. He still appears on conservative national talk shows and makes high-profile speeches in other cities. Earlier this month, he spoke to Donald Trump supporters at their so-called Deplora Ball in Washington, D.C. Clark drew cheers for rejecting the idea that Republicans should reach across the political aisle and work with Democrats. Clark has won four terms as sheriff, running as a Democrat, but he helped Trump campaign. That's not the only unusual thing about Clark. There are also his ongoing feuds with County Executive Chris Abele, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, and even a fellow law enforcement leader, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. Last Saturday, Flynn fired back verbally at Clark. Flynn said a Trump order to have local law enforcement help enforce U.S. immigration laws may be impractical, while Clark is praising the directive.
He probably will get in the way on this and say everything he can do to scare the hell out of people, but mercifully he has very little role, so I don't think it's going to have an impact on the daily lives of the community, but I'm sure he'll do his best to scare people.
A three-decade observer of the Milwaukee criminal justice community says Clark doesn't seem to get along well with any of the local police chiefs. Stan Stojkovic is dean of the School of Social Welfare at the UW-Milwaukee. Stojkovic says Clark makes extreme remarks.
He views himself as a savior, as an individual who's going to come in and do the right thing and catch the bad guy. And if the world was really only that simple, he'd be right. But the world is much more complicated than what he portrays.
Other county officials are investigating Clark for recently calling deputies to confront a man who the sheriff felt didn't respect him on an airplane. The man, Dan Black, filed a complaint. Professor Stojkovic declines to say if Clark abused his power, as the sheriff's critics charge. Stojkovic says the sheriff is more likely to be judged on whether his department is meeting its official responsibilities. Those include patrolling the local freeways, providing security at the airport and county courthouse, and running the Milwaukee County Jail. Four deaths of inmates or a newborn at the lockup last year have prompted some lawsuits and more investigations. So far, though, some local residents are still in Clark's corner. Outside the West Allis post office last Friday, several customers declined to comment about the sheriff, but others said they support Clark. Brian Conkle says he likes the sheriff's independence.
I just like the fact that he doesn't take any crap from anybody else. Everything he does, I think, I'm really on his side.
The sheriff also seems to still have the support of the only official in the state with the power to remove him from office, Governor Scott Walker. Last week, Democratic legislator David Crawley called for Clark's immediate removal based on what the representative says is the sheriff's willful neglect of duties and repeated inappropriate and incendiary comments. The governor, though, says Clark staying on the job is up to voters.
But when the people elect someone, agree or disagree with everything they do or say, I believe it should be ultimately left up to the people of that jurisdiction.
Clark isn't up for re-election until August of next year. However, Democratic activists say they're already recruiting potential challengers if Clark doesn't take a job with the Trump administration in the meantime. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.